look at religion and rationality, and raising the question, what is rationality? Because sometimes religion has been critiqued from the perspective of rationality. Well, it has, often, and particularly in the West. And so I'd be looking at some of the issues of whether there's universal rationality or whether rationality is only particular to certain stages in history or certain cultures. Now, during the French Revolution in 1793, there's a hand up there, Ruby. During the French Revolution in 1793, the Gothic Cathedral of Notre Dame in the Paris was rededicated to the cult of reason, an atheistic doctrine intended to replace Christianity. While it might be ironic that Christianity was to be replaced by a cult, the fundamental idea that reason had or should replace religion as humanity advances is widespread and commonplace as a fundamental implicit assumption of the secular age. The term cult was not used then, of course, in the sociological sense of today, but rather in the ecclesiastical sense of cultus, as a system of devotion. The revolution proclaimed itself to be devoted to reason, which would oust religious faith. In earlier times, reason was seen to be compatible with revelation, and even necessary for knowledge about the truths of God. But in the course of time, reason or rationality, along with empirical inquiry into the world, came to replace revelation as the primary source of knowledge. The French Revolution's rededication of Notre Dame underlines the strong link between rationality and atheism, or anti-religious sentiment, that developed in the West during the course of a couple of hundred years. Religion is understood as superstition in contrast to reason, and the history of religion is understood as a history of error, history of human error. That continental philosopher, Simon Critchley, says that philosophy is inherently atheistic. So it's a very interesting claim that reason, which is an understanding of philosophy, is inherently atheistic in its understanding. So that's something that I want to raise and question and look at.
Sorry, Simon.
Who? Simon Critchley. Oh. I think he says that in a book called Very Little, Almost Nothing. A great title. But the history of religions shows us that rationality is not alien to religious revelation, and there are forms of reasoning that take place within the sacred canopy of religions that are integral to them. The intellectual history of religions is, of course, vast, but if the importance of religion lies in its meaningfulness for human subjects, as I've argued in the last couple of weeks, then rationality is inseparable from this enterprise, because as rational creatures we need good reasons for our practices, and good reasons for thinking that our practices and ideas are related to truth. So people do what they do because they think it's true very often. Now, the question of the relation between rationality, religion, and truth is as vibrant now as it has ever been. We need to raise the question as to what we mean by rationality, whether rationality is a universal property of human beings, to what extent rationality is compatible with religious claims and practices, and the extent to which rationality questions the adequacy of religious claims. These are highly contested issues and virtually imply the whole history of thought, from Plato, the Buddha, and Confucius. For the purpose of today's talk, I wish to support the view that processes of reasoning are shared across cultures, but that these processes are not free from a narrative foundation, that reasoning is integral to reflexive religious traditions and to the meanings they expound, and that the reasoning develops, that reasoning develops within traditions of thought, integrated with imagination, and with ideas about virtue, justice, and truth. So the first question, what is rationality? You've come just at the right time to say, what is rationality? The idea of rationality in the West has been broadly understood as knowledge of truth through inference from valid premises. So you've got these valid premises, and what do you infer from that that leads you to truth? It has also been associated with the development of logic from Aristotle and the two rules of logic, namely the law of non-contradiction, that a statement cannot simultaneously be true and false. It cannot be the case that P and not P, which is formally written, I think, on that handout, I think I've got it as not bracket P and not P, close bracket. That's the formal indication of that. It cannot be both raining and not raining. But then somebody said, well, what about drizzle? Well, it's neither raining nor raining. But that's not... that's to misunderstand the nature of the thing, because it's where raining has to be precisely the same thing in both cases. Whatever is meant by raining, it cannot be both raining and not raining. And the law of the excluded middle, that for any statement P, it is the case that either P or not P, which is in P or the V, not P in brackets, it is the case that either P or not P is true. Either it is raining or it is not raining. Whether raining is understood in exactly the same way in both occurrences. That is, it cannot be both raining and not raining at the same time and in the same place. But we cannot restrict the range of rationality to logical rules. And vagueness is not necessarily antithetical to rationality. We need to understand rationality in terms of human practices that have developed over millennia that involve making judgments in particular situations that are the best means to achieve a particular end. This practical rationality has clearly been practiced throughout history to find food, to hunt, to grow crops, to make shelters. Such practical rationality has also been accompanied by symbolic actions that, from a modern perspective, do not seem to directly contribute to achieving a particular end, such as saying a prayer before hunting, burying a piece of the Eucharist in the field to make the crops grow, and other magical actions. But leaving aside the dispute about causation, it is almost self-evident that cultures throughout history have expressed a belief in the coherence of action and meaning, and that people in different cultures have practiced reasoning as on the basis of what could be known to them. So reasoning is linked to what's known to any human community. That's based on certain premises or certain assumptions about the nature of the world. The debate about rationality has not only been about the application of logical rules to statements, but more broadly about coherence and the degree to which statements correspond to reality. Thus, on the one hand, an argument could be formulated that belief in witchcraft was rational within a non-scientific frame of reference. But on the other hand, such an argument could be refuted on the grounds that science has proved witchcraft to be false because it misunderstands the true nature of causation. So on this view, rationality is linked to understanding the true nature of causation. These are difficult questions, but leaving aside the laws of the excluded middle and the laws of non-contradiction as rules for the adequacy of rational statements, we could claim minimally that rationality entails coherence and intelligibility. Whether coherence and intelligibility entail that a culture must adhere to the two laws of logic articulated is an interesting question. It's clearly possible for people to operate successfully in a society with conflicting or opposed beliefs without too much cognitive dissonance. It's almost self-evident the truth that we inhabit different worlds or different provinces of meaning. To use Schutz's phrase, but to function successfully in a society, we do need to operate within some intelligibility. Each person in a culture needs to make the world and her fellow travellers intelligible, and a schema for doing so, for doing this, we might call a culture's rationality. So, on this view, rationality is a culture of intelligibility. Thus, the implicit schema for understanding the ancient Greek world was dike, translated as justice, implying cosmic order in the way parallel to the Indian idea of dharma, translated as duty or virtue, and again implying cosmic order. The schemas of a culture are not necessarily articulated, but are, in principle, communicable. Although often only a culture's intellectual elites will be in a position to articulate those presuppositions adequately, those cultural assumptions. A culture's schema involves a narrative dimension, story or an account of a series of events, and reflection on the narrative or explanation. As I've written elsewhere, religion has been understood as story, a true story for those who stand inside of it, and an explanation of story has been a function of rationality. But it could be argued that the Enlightenment claim to free reason from narrative or myth has never been wholly successful or even desirable, and that there are narrative structures important to reason in the sense that good reasons for practices might be supported by examples from life. Even in Hegel's emphasis on reason, the whole manifesting of the spirit through history involves a story right up to Hegel's declaring the end of history with Napoleon's entry into Jena. He sees Napoleon on his white horse coming into Jena. That's the end of history. But then he has to run away with his manuscript from the French troops. The structure of reason entails a narrative aspect through being articulated in time. That is, reason entails communication, and communication often takes the form of narrative. We tell stories to make a point and reflect upon the meaning of those stories. Genet, who's a French theorist on all this, right, makes a useful distinction, I think, between story, histoire, and a series of events, or series of events, and narrative. A narrative, he says, is a discourse about those events. That's quite a useful distinction between story itself and reflection on the story, which he says is narrative. We might also say that rationality entails communication and communicability, not necessarily across the boundaries of traditions, but certainly within those boundaries. The schemas which operate within a culture provide some coherence to people's experience of life. Cultural schemas constrain our desires and emotions, which, as McIntyre observes, are norm-governed. And we have to learn what the norms of a society are, and both how to express ourselves and lead others' emotions within that society. One way of understanding culture and implicitly understanding rationality has been the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein's famous idea of forms of life, that we live in a particular mode of being characterized by language games, in which the important thing about language is its use rather than any objective referent. Like a game, language is determined by conventions or rules, and we need to understand and evaluate statements according to the conventions operative for that particular language. As the moves in a game can be only judged by what is and is not permissible, i.e. the rules, and the rule of one game cannot legitimately or even coherently be applied to another game, so language must be understood in terms of the rules or constraints operating upon it in particular circumstances, in a way that extends beyond natural languages to areas of meaning within a single natural language. Thus, the linguistic conventions operating at a birthday party will be different to those operating in a business meeting or in the House of Commons. One language game is self-contained and closed off from another. On this line of reasoning, cultures operate in analogous ways to language. They are self-regulating entities that contain their own rules or constraints, and we must make sense of cultures in terms of their own frames of reference. Rationality is the ability to follow a rule, and the set of rules might be understood as a schema implicit in cultures. Against universalizing criteria of judgment that fed into colonialism and the relegation of the West's other to a subordinate status, anthropologists and many philosophers in the post-Second World War era tended to agree with the view of cultures as closed systems or forms of life, along with the idea that there are different kinds of rationality, that rationality is bound by culture. On this view, cultures need to be understood in their own terms as having their own coherence. A philosophical justification for understanding cultures in this way was developed by Peter Winch, influenced by Wittgenstein. Cultures have their own standards of rationality, and we cannot judge one culture, one form of life, through the standards of rationality developed in another. In The Idea of a Social Science and Its Relation to Philosophy, which was published in 1958, Winch argued, beginning with the Wittgenstein's aphorism, that the limits of my language, of the only language I can understand, mean the limits of my world. End quote. for the importance of formation of our experience through language and social context. He does not use the word culture, he uses the term social context. The world is not separable from language in the sense that the world is what is presented to us through concepts, and so religion and philosophy are attempts to present an intelligible picture of the world to us on this Winch's view. A key part to our understanding the world is being able to follow a rule. Developing Wittgenstein's argument that we can only make sense of the words the same, through being able to grasp the idea of a rule and to know when it is or is not coherently followed, which claims that we can extend this idea to social life apart from language. Action always has a relation to a social context and must be understood as the application of a rule driven by motives and reasons. That is, I can only be committed to the future by what I do now if any present act is the application of a rule. I can only be committed to the future if what I do now is the application of a rule. Otherwise, you can't be committed to the future because it becomes random, it becomes unpredictable. And so a person must know what the right and wrong way of doing something is. Thus, in voting Labour, a person must live in a particular country with a particular political institution, must understand what it is to follow a rule. Casting a vote is not simply making a mark on a piece of paper. I guess that's why voting was... people in insane asylums weren't allowed to vote, were they? Because they didn't know what it was to follow a rule, I suppose, on that view. Now, this extends to all aspects of social life. So a religious mystic, this is a quote from Winch, a religious mystic, for instance, who says that his aim is union with God, can be understood by someone who is acquainted with the religious tradition in the context of which this end is sought. End quote. To live in a society is to be able to act, which is to have reasons for acting within a framework of rules, and thereby to know that there is a right or wrong way of doing something. In Weber's terms, this is rational action in relation to a goal, Zweckrationell. For Winch, all meaningful behaviour must be social, since it can be meaningful only if governed by rules, and rules presuppose a social setting. The implicit and explicit rules which govern social action are relative to particular societies, and to follow these rules is to behave meaningfully for people who live within that particular form of life. To understand neurosis among the Trobriand Islanders, for example, we would need to understand the Trobriand concept of fatherhood and so on. And not simply import an account of the etiology of neurosis from Freud. For Winch, we need to understand people in their own terms, in their own social contexts, an idea he develops in Understanding a Primitive Society, where, relying on an account of Evans Pritchard, he discusses Azandi notions of witchcraft. Such practices, rather than being judged by the external anthropologists as being irrational, must be understood as being coherent within their social frame of reference, and providing a meaningful world that the Azandi inhabit. For example, the Azandi perform a rite while harvesting their crops, which anthropologists have interpreted as a way whereby the Azandi try to ensure a good crop return, i.e. a magical act. But Winch argues that understanding Azandi culture through the lens of such instrumental rationality is a mistake. Rather, we must understand Azandi rites as expressive activity, not as instrumental. That is, the Azandi actions are intelligible not as a kind of technology, but as the expression of their freedom from dependence on the harvest, through actually expressing this dependence. So there's a kind of an irony or a homeopathy perhaps operating, that the Azandi express dependence on the harvest, but through that articulation they're thereby stating their own freedom from it. To view the Azandi rites as erroneous technology is to impose European assumptions about instrumentality. To see the Azandi belief in witchcraft as erroneous is to assume that science corresponds to reality, and this makes assumptions about language corresponding or pointing to a reality outside of itself. This issue was brought out some years ago in the context of post-colonialism and the debate about the British military explorer Captain Cook, who was killed on Hawaii in 1779. Cook was deified as the god Lono, as he so happened to arrive on Hawaii during the god Lono's festival, which I guess you would think that, wouldn't you, if you're Hawaiian and then this character turns up. And he was treated as with honour and respect. After a short stay, Cook sailed away, but was forced to return because of a problem with the mainsail on one of the ships. He was subsequently killed by the Hawaiians on the beach. But this was no mere killing. It was a sacrifice, claims Sarlins. As the god Lono, Cook received obeisance and respect, but upon his return he disrupted the cultural expectation, and a complex of events eventuated in a cultural improvisation which became a sacrifice. So the god's left us, but he's come back, so they were puzzled by the god coming back. He shouldn't come back. So what does this mean? Ah, it must mean that he has to be sacrificed. That was according to Sarlins, that's the cultural logic. So, to quote Sarlins, Cook was transformed from the divine beneficiary of the sacrifice to the victim, end quote. The sacrifice of the king or deity was a practice not unknown, and Cook's body was dismembered exactly in accordance with Hawaiian sacrificial practice. The killing of Cook is coherent within the frame of reference of the Hawaiians at that time. Now, the anthropologist Gananat Obeyesekera argued against Sarlins' interpretation, claiming that it is a European myth that places the Europeans as rational above the natives, who are still within a mythical universe and characterized by a primitive mentality which irrationally took Cook to be their god. On the contrary, argues Obeyesekera, the Hawaiians performed a practical rationality which is shared by all human beings, rooted in our biological nature. And the Hawaiians were fully aware of the political dimensions of the Cook expedition. Sarlins, in turn, accused Obeyesekera of a kind of ethnocentrism and viewing the Hawaiians as Europeans. So it's a very engaging interchange, which I would encourage you to read. The Apotheosis of Captain Cook by Obeyesekera. And Marshall Sarlin's response in a book about 10 years ago now called What Natives Think About Captain Cook, for example. I think, whilst arguably Marshall Sarlin's deep knowledge and scholarship about Hawaii possibly has the edge over Obeyesekera, but Obeyesekera nevertheless raises important questions about rationality and Western hegemony. But these two understandings are not necessarily antagonistic, and cultural coherence does not necessarily entail untranslatability, or that there is no shared practical rationality. We have seen the same issue with regard to Edie Turner's experience among the Ndembu. I had the honour of having dinner with Edie Turner once a few years ago, and she was the wife of Victor Turner, and they thought all this communist stuff up in her kitchen, she said. But she returned to the Ndembu in West Africa, and on this ritual, she underwent a certain experience. There was a ritual that if someone's possessed by witchcraft, they all get together and exorcise the demon that's inside of them, and it comes out as a tooth. That was the idea, and there's pictures in her book Experiencing Ritual, and so she participated in his exorcism, and she said she saw this tooth being withdrawn from the person's back with her own eyes. She said she saw this tooth coming up, and it was quite. And there was at the end there was everyone calmed down because the tooth had been extracted and put into a bag. Now the Ihamba truth ritual can be understood within the cultural logic of the Ndembu worldview. Magical affliction by the hunter's tooth is part of the cultural norms of the society. As Evans Pritchard remarked with regard to witchcraft beliefs among the Azandi, not to come across witchcraft on a daily basis would be the cause of surprise for an Azandi. It is simply part of the everyday world. Yet even understanding the Denbu or Azandi worldview assumes some common shared ground between the anthropologists and their informants. It assumes that intelligibility and coherence are translatable. While it might not be possible to establish semantic universals, as some of them, like Virbitschka, that Australian linguist, wrote a book called Semantic Universals, there are nevertheless shared processes of linguistic consensus and metaphorical use. It is these processes that we call rational. It is rational to agree what it is to win a football match because participants know what it is to follow a rule. By extension, in the case of the Denbu exorcism rite, there was an agreement as to whether the woman was cured of witchcraft affliction or not, and an implicit cultural understanding of the rules of exorcism and what constitutes a cure. In the Denbu case, there is a coherence in the belief system, and judgments are made and acted upon which are based on that system. Whether such judgments are based on a mistaken understanding of causation is a different question. But insofar as the belief system is coherent, it is arguably rational. In many ways, Winch is a precursor of some postmodern thinking that stresses the particularity of cultural difference and as different worlds, and these different worlds are formed within language. There is nothing outside the text, in Derrida's famous phrase, which clearly has a point that to act meaningfully in a particular culture, even to know how to speak in particular social situations, is to follow a rule. To know when the rule has been broken and to understand the concept of the same. He makes a big deal about this notion of the same. Even within a single society, there are many different forms of life which contain different language games. For example, hello, how are you, is a form of greeting in American English, which could not be used to mark a farewell. People would find it very strange if you said that and then nif. The recitation of the opening verses of the Quran is a form of language used in a particular situation of Muslim prayer. In one sense, language games are self-contained, and to understand their intelligibility, we have to enter into them. And yet there's a sense in which Winch's argument is limited. Of course we need to understand cultures, religions, and languages in their own terms, but the very idea of making something intelligible entails a shared ground, entails the ability to make judgments, discern intelligibility, and therefore entails shared processes of reasoning. This in turn entails some notion of correspondence between language and reality, and it is here where so many problems lie. One community's correspondence is another's imagination. If religions are cultural forms that mediate the human encounter with mystery, then these forms are coherent in the sense that practices and beliefs create an integrated worldview, an implicit schema which participants can comprehend. To live within an Orthodox Jewish community is to know how to follow its rules, to know how to behave in the synagogue, and to know how to make judgments in particular situations based on the values of that community, such as choices to eat within a limited kosher, within the limits of kosher in a restaurant. These are all judgments people have to make all the time. But the question still remains as to whether the same standards of rationality can be applied across cultures. As we've seen, Winch has argued against the view that standards of Western rationality can be applied universally, and has argued that rationality within a particular culture must be linked to coherence and the ability to follow a rule. Probing this question further, Charles Taylor has argued that Winch's defence of Azandi practices against the accusation of irrationalism on the grounds that they are engaged in quite a different language game is not enough. What is needed is not only coherence, but the ability to give an account of a practice or an idea. That is, an important part of rationality is the ability to articulate an activity and to reflect upon it or develop a theoretical understanding, such a theoretical understanding in the Greek tradition is a disengaged perspective linked to contemplation and true knowledge. Quote Taylor, we have a rational grasp of something when we can articulate it. which is why the Greek philosophical vocabulary marks its inner connection between speech and reason. End quote. This ability to articulate reasons is the ability to formulate a theoretical understanding of a social practice, and some cultures, suggests Taylor, are theoretical in this sense, and some cultures are not. Winch's objection to reading as anti-magic in terms of practical rationality is, on Taylor's re-description, an objection to an atheoretical culture being judged by the standards of a theoretical culture. Cultures which theorize their practices are able to articulate them, give reasons for doing what they do, and so, Taylor argues, are superior in one sense to cultures which do not. This is not to accuse the Azandi of irrationality, says Taylor, because to be irrational is to violate the standards of rationality within a particular culture through inconsistency. But it is to acknowledge that standards are different when understood in terms of the expression of a theoretical understanding versus a non-theoretical understanding. This distinction between theoretical and non-theoretical cultures is clearly controversial. This is not simply a covert colonialism. Is this not simply a covert colonialism, or way of claiming the superiority of the West over the Third World? Such, I think, would be an ungenerous reading of Taylor's point. While all societies are complex, some cultures have a historical density that has brought with it a sustained theoretical reflection over a long expanse of time. But this is not enough for Taylor, for what marks out the modern from the earlier kinds of rationality is a link to science, empirical knowledge, and the abandoning of attunement that saw the meaning of human life linked to the structure of the cosmos. To this important point, we'll need to return. But the key argument that Taylor presents is that rationality entails not only coherence, but also articulation. While Winch's claim that we need to understand cultural practices on their own terms is important, Taylor's account of rationality as entailing articulation is attested by the histories of civilization in Asia, Europe, and in the Middle East, which developed sophisticated accounts of their cultural and religious practices, and a range of theoretical reflection on the human encounter with mystery. These theoretical reflections were often at odds, but all illustrate Taylor's principle. Buddhism, for example, expressed in texts and traditions from the 5th century, made headway into Central Asia, China, and Southeast Asia in due course, and now into the West. Rationality would seem to entail not simply cultural coherence or intelligibility for a community, but also articulation and communicability. I think that's terribly important, communicability. It is possible to learn another's language, to learn other's rules, and to learn to live within other ways of life. Geoffrey Lloyd, for example, has shown how ancient China and Greece shared techniques of persuasion. And that one might add that ancient India too developed such techniques. Indeed, for religions that had a missionary goal, namely Buddhism, Christianity, and Islam, such communicability of rationality was central to their very nature. The ability to render themselves intelligible was essential to the communicative acts that marked them. As Donald Davison has argued, the ability to translate others' concepts into one's own language entails that we live in the same world. Davison's famous principle of charity offers a generous view of communication that we should optimize agreement, and in so doing optimize the meaning of other statements. That is, beliefs attributed to others come out as largely true. A distinct, although relative thesis is Davison's radical interpretation that works out the meaning of linguistic utterances without prior knowledge of grammar or speaker's mental states, through working out the meaning from the context of linguistic use. So you don't know the grammar and the structures beforehand, but you work out the meaning from the use in practical context. You see a rabbit and someone says gavagai, and you go from there, whether it's a rabbit or rabbit stuff. This is, in fact, to recognize the cohesiveness and the truth of the speaker. This method is intended not to eradicate disagreement, but to make meaningful disagreement possible, and assumes a foundation in agreement. For Davison, meaning entails a theory of truth, according to which, following the philosopher Tarski, the meaning of a sentence is given by providing it with truth conditions. Furthermore, radical interpretation is needed to link utterances to evidence, and so Davison defends a version of the correspondence theory of truth, that truth can be explained by an appeal between language and the world. Through speaking sentences, we can say what is true. On this view, not only coherence is important for truth and rationality, but correspondence between language and reality is too. Thus, S is true if and only if P, it is snowing is true if and only if it is snowing. Sane and insane understandings of the world have been judged by criteria of the correspondence between statements and reality. But even here, as philosophers of social history such as Foucault have pointed out, what is judged sane by one culture or one period in history, such as witchcraft accusations, might be judged insane by another. The more relativistic position of McIntyre and John Milbank argue against Davison on the grounds that cultural languages have to be mastered on their own terms without translatability. And there are no rival positions that are incompatible with, there are rival positions that are incompatible with each other. But evidence from the human sciences suggests that human beings are, as Brandon claims, normative beings with the ability to commit ourselves to particular statements and courses of action and to articulate those commitments, and rational beings with the ability to rationally navigate difference and to understand the reasons to undertake a commitment. We have the ability to make explicit what is implicit in our language. The important point for our purpose is that ideas and beliefs can be communicated, and even though we can enter into different social worlds, those different social worlds are translatable. So, cultures are rational then, to the degree that they are coherent, and to the degree that cultural judgments can be articulated. So articulation of cultural judgments is very important, and that those can be communicated across different cultural divides. Within a community, an act is rational if the judgment that precedes it is coherent in the context of other actions and the world picture that allowed that judgment to be made. So I do think, in a way, that Azandi witchcraft accusations are rational when viewed from within their cultural parameters. This entails it being able to be articulated. Coherence and communicatability are the hallmarks of rationality, and communities are rational in which these processes occur. This does not mean, of course, that rational culture is more ethical. Look at the Aztec, which was clearly rational, but whose mass sacrificial culture was unethical when judged from the perspective of the West. Not that that justified the mass extermination of the Aztecs by Europe. While it might be difficult to make judgments about of different cultures based on ethics, it could be argued that an ethical understanding is integral to the world itself, part of the structure, very structure of reality. And while particular judgments might be brought into question, the fact of ethical judgment, as shared, points to such a conclusion. In spite of some alternative descriptions, such as Kierkegaard's "I believe because it is absurd," religious communities are rational communities, forms of life that are coherent, communicable, and ethical. Alison McIntyre, in particular, has developed historical philosophical accounts of moral rationality in relation to these traditions. Modernity lost the idea of virtue, which has been preserved in the Aristotelian Thomistic tradition, according to McIntyre, when moral reasoning and any claim to universal morality were rejected after the Enlightenment, particularly with Nietzsche and the genealogical thinking. Modernity and postmodernity have lost an important kind of discourse that needs to be retrieved for the collective good. On this account, religious rationality is an important dimension of meaning, being located within a cosmos and being part of a larger structure which gives life coherence, is a moral source which itself is rooted in and expresses God on religious views. Charles Taylor's description of the Renaissance world, in which attunement to the cosmos was a central feature of understanding, is an illustration of this. Science breaks the link between understanding and attunement, and so puts a strain on the maintaining of religious meaning in modernity. I'll talk about another 8 minutes. So the end is in sight. So far, I've argued that the humans share rationality in the sense that we attempt to make sense of our strange world and offer intelligible and consistent accounts of it that are communicable. Religions are rational in this sense. They offer accounts of the world, particularly the origin of the world. They offer accounts of the meaning of human life and death. And they offer ways of negotiating the difficult boundaries of life. And they offer an ultimate meaning in liberation or salvation. We can also concur with Taylor that there are theoretical and non-theoretical cultures, which do not necessarily map onto literate and non-literate, but maps onto philosophical and non-philosophical practices of reasoning. Ancient India was a self-reflexive theoretical culture, although predominantly oral in its earliest phase, that developed rational forms of knowledge and developed scientific approaches to the world, particularly the science of language, but also mathematics and astronomy. Theoretical cultures, as Taylor argued, have strong account of rationality, and these cultures developed to a high degree in China, India, Europe, and the Middle East. The German existential philosopher Karl Jaspers first drew our attention to the idea of the axial age during the first millennium BC that marked the rise of new developments in world history, with the Buddha and the Upanishads in India, Confucius, Lao Tzu, and the Hebrew prophets, and Socrates in Greece. The rise of these new religions or new forms of older religions marks a shift from an orientation from magical manipulation of supernatural forces towards a rational ethics. Leaving aside the question about the viability of the axial age concept and the problem of whether there are parallel historical developments in different areas of the world, I take the general point that we can make a distinction between magical practices or popular religion and religions of salvation that offered an ethical worldview and the processes of reasoning. The development of the axial revolution, Taylor observes, reaches its logical conclusion with an emphasis away from collective cosmos-related rituals towards individuated religion and devotion in the Middle Ages to the Renaissance. This shift, he argues, he calls the great disembedding. The history of religions might be seen in terms of a tension between these two kinds of religion, which developed to its logical conclusion with the gradual erosion and disparaging of magical traditions, culminating with the rise of science. Although there have been developed scientific cultures in India and China from an early period, the break between attunement and understanding, or explanation, only becomes marked during the Renaissance with the rise of humanistic scholarship and science. So there are examples that I could go into of kinds of rationality. I was going to talk about them. Take three examples of Al-Ghazali, Shemaraja, and Anselm, who are all contemporaries with each other, but all who develop kinds of reasoning based within the parameters of their own traditions. But just by way of conclusion, then, I've argued that the processes of rationality are shared, but rationality is always linked to traditions of thought and practice. Religious reasoning has been traditionally associated with institutions that fostered and developed practices of thinking that assumed a particular revelation of and sacred cosmos. Monasticism in Buddhist India and then in Europe were particularly important developments in the formation of religious reasoning, but also the yeshivas and the madrasas. These forms of religious reasoning can be contrasted with modern scientific rationality that developed particularly since the Enlightenment in the West, although clearly there was scientific reasoning arguments based on empirical evidence from an early period in India and China. Different kinds of rationality therefore govern human cultural actions, although there's probably a spectrum here, and it makes sense to speak of Christian hermeneutics And it does make sense to speak of Christian hermeneutics, but I'm not sure that it makes sense to speak of Christian physics or Hindu mathematics. I suspect that the more empirical the claim a tradition makes, the more open to empirical falsification that they are, the less bound by the particularity of culture and language they are. So the more a tradition makes claims that are empirically verifiable or falsifiable, the less bound to tradition it is. Although never wholly free from human tradition, the meaning of religious action must therefore be understood both in terms of intentionality, reason for action, and in terms of significance for a community. The intentionality of act, the complex of willing that results in action, is itself based on basic cultural assumptions encoded in language and other cultural institutions, kinship patterns, for example. I've argued that what is characteristic of religious acts is that while they are clearly cultural, they articulate or give expression to an aspect of the real that would otherwise remain concealed. The dance possession rites of Kerala, the Teyam rites, are unique to Kerala in style and content, language, gesture, costume, music, but they open out a realm of the real for a participating community. This is similar to the case of the Ahamba tooth ritual among the Ndembu. In more prosaic examples, one might say that this structure holds true in the Muslim daily prayers and in Christian Mass. The importance of religion, therefore, lies in the meaning of religious performance for agents who act in certain ways, and the significance of those actions for the community. Sometimes these are small acts, offering incense to Ganesh. Sometimes actions spawn a civilization, the Buddha's meditation or Christ's crucifixion. It's all very well, one might say, that reasoning is within the bounds of tradition, and this can be empirically demonstrated from the numerous examples in the history of civilizations, but are these modes of reasoning adequate for assessing human truth? Clearly, as McIntyre has shown, traditional reasoning, particularly moral reasoning, is within traditions of thinking. But some might wish to argue for the superiority of the encyclopedist or modernist practices of reasoning on the grounds that social coherence and meaning are not enough for the justification of irrational belief systems. Scientific reasoning gives us truth. Religious reasoning gives us falsehood on that view. This is a familiar view from Marx, who saw his thinking as based on scientific empirical grounds, to Dawkins and biological reductionists. Even theologians might adhere to this view and claim that religious reasoning needs to stand up to the rigors of scientific truth based on firm knowledge, particularly derived from science. Truth is objective, and language needs to be adequate to express it. So, what I would argue then is that reasoning is always culturally bound; is always within traditions of human societies. But reasoning can transcend those cultural boundaries, and when forms of reasoning make empirical claims, they're open to falsification. But when they don't make empirical claims, they are still within they're more rooted in the bounds of their tradition. And arguably, there are different kinds of human good and different kinds of human truth. So. I mean, we're all rational people in this room, but we might well say something and then touch wood to make sure that there are elements of superstition in all our ways of life. So no human beings are completely purely rational, nor is it desirable that they be so. In other words, I think I'm still thinking about this, and I think it's just still going on. So I'll shut up, and we've got 10 minutes for.
I'll ask a question.
Go on.
If I'm not sure. And it's a really vague question because I'm really interested in these topics which I'm interested in as well, mostly coming out from a few people like Berger and Geertz, and there's a kind of existentialist anthropological school that tries to work out what constitutes worldviews. And I think your sources maybe are doing a much better job of looking at the details of how a rational and coherent world is structured and what it is to have rules that are followable, but not just rules, principles underlying them. Like, I think that's an interesting distinction you've made between what it is to have rules, which you can learn and you can articulate, but once someone's learnt all the rules, if they don't present a set of rules that are explainable by underlying principles, as it were, then they're not rational, they're just a game.
Yeah.
So I think that that rules to principles step is an interesting one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And makes them articulatable in a different way.
Yeah.
So I think that phrase articulatable is interesting, but maybe slightly vaguely used by the thinkers in question. Anyway, my question's about thinking about this from my own perspective, which is very Geertzian. Geertz's notion of religion as a worldview with its own picture of, if you like, fact, which becomes adhered to on various bases. He, which is not the same, but in my mind is related, he talks about what it is that makes us jump from a worldview to another one.
Mm.
So not just articulating it so you can get in and see the meaning, but what makes the thing be real.
Mm.
And addresses perhaps this issue that a lot of anthropologists have had to address, that you don't just get born into one cultural text or game and then you're in it forever and you can see into the other one, but you can't ever get into it. The notion that you get to, you know, we can switch, as it were.
Mm.
And he kind of talks about the effectiveness of a worldview and the moods and motivations that give it this particular quality of realness, as it were. Is there anything, and I'm not, I think that might be a problematic or too vague an account on his part, in, maybe I missed it, but is there a place in your thinking about this where we can talk about what it is that makes us not only understand the rules and be in that world of coherence, but start to adopt it? What is it that constitutes the truthfulness of it?
That's interesting, yeah. Why do people adopt?
Yeah, what does its convincingness?
Yeah. Because we've grown up, I mean, most people are in particular religions because they've grown up in that religion. But so what makes you adopt a new world view or something? Or what are the principles underlying it? I think it's probably something else. It's a search for me. That Jewish psychoanalysis, the logocentrism, logotherapy or something, with the human need for meaning, deep human need for meaning, I would say, which is cross-cultural.
So a system may suddenly appear to give more meaning than another system,
yes.
And that's what accounts for its becoming more true.
Yes, yes. And for a particular group, that might become more meaningful because of the inadequacy of the system they're in. It's not answering certain kind of needs, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's interesting.
It seems related to your point about reasoning and rationality. If the religion you're brought up in isn't satisfying the reason and rationality, then you're probably naturally still looking at others and assessing them in similar ways and seeing if they fill in those gaps.
Mm.
Yeah. It's interesting when something may be extra meaningful, but maybe its coherence value starts to be disrupted. People start having to make weird choices about which one they value more. It's meaningful.
That's right.
Or its coherence.
Yeah. Maybe people change their minds when anomalies crop up in their experience and their pattern needs to be changed or expanded.
Cognitive dissonance.
Cognitive dissonance. We can live with a high degree of cognitive dissonance, I think.
Often that meaning thing and the coherence, I mean, rationality and meaningfulness, our meaning, of course, has this two different meanings. On the one hand, it means semantic meaning, but it also has the sense of value, and often the value and the coherence go against each other, of course. We rather like some dissonance than some magic about it, I think.
That's right.
The Trinity
makes race. Life interesting, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if someone is living with an extreme degree of cognitive dissonance, then one would suspect their sanity, wouldn't anyway? But they would. I don't know. That'd be difficult, I think.
I know it's in some religions. It seems that cognitive dissonance or some sort of paradox is actually fostered as a way to mind expansion. I'm thinking of Buddhist koans
or
the sayings of these Sufi masters, which are deliberately enigmatic,
yes,
in order to kind of stretch your mind.
It's the hand of one time clapping and that kind of thing. That's right, that disrupts rational thought.
Well, even the desert fathers would come out with something so weird, but kind of often laced with humour or irony, in order to kind of stretch the mind of the listener.
Who is it who says that it's the, I'm trying to think how I think of the notion that we need these constructed and coherent world structures to live in, but actually it's often the points of transcendence of them or something, which often means disruption, that attracts us most. I mean, Spavier says that in a nasty way, but I'm trying to think who says it in a nice way.
There's supposed to be a parallel in science there between normal, so-called normal and revolutionary science, where saying anomalies build up until the whole pattern has to be changed, like, I don't know, shaking a kaleidoscope or something. And then you get a whole new world view, but where the original one is not falsified, but relegated to a kind of a set of limiting circumstances, so the more enlarged pattern. I'm thinking of sort of classical and quantum, kind of
quantum
classical physics,
yes,
and quantum physics.
Yeah. Well, quantum physics is certainly, I mean, that's that seems to go against laws, doesn't it? Well, the laws of the Newtonian physics, but that disrupts those. And
I'm not sure it goes against them. I think the Newtonian physics is like a limiting case of relativity, as I understand it.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. Yeah.
Just back to Peter Winch and... You mentioned how he brings out the idea of activity being expressive, and I think that was contrasted with being merely functional. Was that the term?
Practical rationality versus expressive, or something like that. But these actions of the Azandi and so on are not like technology, but they're symbolic actions.
Okay. What was the example? It was taking something out to the field.
The Azandi,
the crops.
For the crop time, They perform a certain ritual for the crop time. And it's not to make, the crops grow, but it's to express their transcendence of their dependence on nature.
I just want to talk about that. You mentioned something about rationality providing the basis for development of moral codes.
Well, according to some philosophers like Taylor, thinks that rationality is very much linked into the notion of value of moral codes and virtues, and that there's a, and McIntyre thinks that rationality leads you to the conclusion of certain moral principles, and that cultures which disrupt those are but they're not irrational, but I mean he would say that McIntyre or Taylor would want to maintain that ethical rationality is better than non-ethical rationality, and
so
you can judge cultures on that.
Science hasn't given us any answers to sort of.
No, according to McIntyre, that hasn't at all.
Kill each other.
That's right.
In our sort of competitive world.
That's right. The Age of Enlightenment. The meaning of life? Monty Python film is. The opening scene is there's a great battle going on, and it says the Age of Reason. Exactly. McIntyre says that actually, the Age of Reason is
it's sort of based
lost
on
virtue,
myth, isn't it? The Lost Eden, in a way.
Yeah.
Sort of
it's based on a myth.
Yeah.
But it doesn't. It's blind to it. That's the problem.
Yeah.
The Age of Reason is blind to its own narrative dimension, and it thinks it's objective truth, thinks it's corresponding to reality, whereas it's actually another tradition of reasoning.
Can I ask one more question? Sorry, but is the back here to the description of the world, does that include, is there also then an articulatable coherent structure to the values within that world that can be similarly conveyed and articulated?
Possibly. It's a very interesting question.
Because if so, then that means you can not only communicate the truths, but also the values of the other religious world. But if not, and if values sometimes aren't coherent or adhere to structural disruptions or things that just don't fit into languages, that would mean that actually we could, that would explain why we have serious problems in articulating religious value as well as world pictures.
An interesting question. I mean, I suspect that, I mean, religions have lasted such a long time. I suspect that there's something about the structure of the world itself that the religions articulate or the ethical codes articulate.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe that's a magical worldview I'm articulating there.
It's the question about the aesthetics and aesthetic taste and things like that. It goes into that area of what it is to.
It could be part of our brains. I mean, if these neuroscientists show us that our there's a certain universality to the brain, and the ethical ways of behaving correspond to deep structures in our brains and a deep sociality, then that's very interesting. Then that implies a certain universality, certain universalism of thinking and being, which moves completely away from the cultural relativism of. Of the post-Winchians in a way, and moves towards a new understanding of the human, possibly. So let's fold up and
thank you
for coming.
Thank you.